Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This morning, the international debate over the future of Iraq returns to the same international stage where it began 2 years ago. The UN headquarters in New York, President George Bush will make his case for the transition in Iraq, saying, as he has for the past few months, that the work is hard and it is dangerous, but it's all worthwhile in leading that country toward elections and democracy. But he's not the first to speak today. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan takes the podium first, and he'll give world leaders a much more critical review of the situation in Iraq. He's already on record in a recent BBC interview with Owen Bennett-Jones as calling the war illegal.
Do you think that the resolution that was passed on Iraq before the war did actually give legal authority to do what was done?
Well, I'm one of those who believe that there should have been a second resolution, because the Security Council indicated that if Iraq did not comply, there will be consequences. But then it was up to the Security Council to approve or determine what those consequences should be.
So you don't think there was legal authority for the war?
I have stated clearly that it was not in conformity with the Security Council, with the UN Charter.
It was illegal?
Yes, if you wish.
It was illegal?
Yes, I've indicated it's not in conformity with the UN Charter. From our point of view, from the Charter point of view, it was illegal.
For both Annan and Bush, the future of Iraq remains the most crucial and divisive issue, and it's much more than an academic disagreement. The UN is supposed to help run elections in Iraq due to take place in the next 4 months. But the United Nations says it can't do the work given the level of violence in that country. So what happens next? Can the U.S. and the U.N. put aside their differences? Or is the United States better off operating independently without searching for the consensus of other countries and other leaders? This issue has also become a key point in the American election. How much does international cooperation matter anymore? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going to start the hour with Peter Greer. Peter is Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's watching the president's speech at the UN this morning. Hi, Peter.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
What are you going to be listening for when the president speaks a little later this morning?
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that it's very important for President Bush to have international participation in elections in Iraq in January, as you mentioned. So he has to go some way towards mollifying his international critics about his course of action in Iraq. And so I'm going to be seeing, you know, exactly how much does he reach out to them? Kind of how soft is he in his approach to the rest of the world?
There's a risk in that for him, though, is there not? Because in terms of solidifying his own base, he's been pretty hard in saying, we made the tough choice, we'll take the responsibility for making that choice. And that base isn't going to, at least in the United States, going to want him to see him backtrack on any of that.
Well, that's true. You know, as you well know, in his stump speeches, to say he denigrates the UN in essence, and that's an applause line. But you've got to remember that this speech today is a different context. When a president goes before the UN Security Council, it's a little bit, it's a ritual. It's a little bit like when they go before a joint session of Congress for the State of the Union. This is the state of U.S. foreign policy in the world. So they typically take a different tone, and I would expect President Bush to do that.
So, in fact, he'll be talking to two audiences. There'll be a message in there for the global leaders who are gathered in New York, and there will be something for the U.S. domestic audience as well.
That's true. But again, I'm going to come back to elections, because for President Bush, the whole process in Iraq, or the whole future of the U.S. involvement in Iraq, is dependent upon process. You know, he's going, January elections. And that is, to him, in essence, the thing that will symbolize that there is progress and that things have happened that are good. It's a way of kind of getting past the continued violence, mm-hmm. the growing insurgency, and focusing on process that Americans can understand.
Peter, thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Peter Greer, Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Joining us this hour, John Ruggie, professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's here in the studio with me. John, nice to have you back.
Good morning.
And Max Boot's with us. He's senior fellow with Council on Foreign Relations, joining us from NPR Studios in New York. Max, it's nice to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me on.
John Ruggie, if I can start with you, because just a bit of process for our own listeners, we're waiting right now for Kofi Annan to step to the podium at the UN headquarters in New York. When his speech is underway, we hope to bring a little bit of that to you, and then Bush will speak later this morning. What's the priority John, for the Secretary General in his speech?
Generally, Dick, this is a little bit like a State of the Union address. This is the seventh one that Kofi Annan has given. It's unique among those seven in being focused on a single theme, and that is the decline in the rule of international law, or the international rule of law, in fact, he puts it, because he concerns himself both with domestic and international law in the context of the speech. This is a plea from the Secretary General that if the international community doesn't pay more attention to fundamental rules of civilized behavior, we're going to degenerate even further into the laws of the jungle than we already have.
Translate that for me, though, in context of what we're talking about with Peter. What is he saying to President Bush? What's he saying to the U.S. administration?
What he's saying to President Bush, after a balanced defense of the rule of law in his speech, he says it all has to begin with the principle that no one is above the law. Because if the most powerful are seen to flout the law and to exempt themselves from the law, what credibility does it have for anyone else? That subtext is there loud and clear in the Secretary General's speech this morning, and it won't endear him any further to the Bush administration than he did with his comment last week about the Iraq war being illegal.
And Max Boot, you heard the piece of the BBC interview that we started the program with. Based on what John is saying we should expect in Kofi Annan's speech, is he going too far here, in your view?
I think he did go too far in the BBC interview. In fairness, he was pressed to go far by the county interviewer. But, you know, I think his substantive point that the intervention in Iraq was illegal is just wrong. I don't think it was any more illegal than the intervention in Kosovo in 1999, which also did not have the blessing of the UN Security Council. But beyond the substance of it, I just think politically it was a ham-handed thing to say, because the international community, the coalition in Iraq, is locked in a life-or-death struggle right now with a powerful guerrilla movement which practices terrorism on a terrifying scale that has no regard for human life. And the objective in Iraq, which the United Nations shares with the United States, Britain, and other powers, is to have a free and democratically elected government. And it does not help to have that government emerge in order to have the Secretary General of the United Nations casting doubt on the legitimacy of the intervention which is currently going on, which I might add has been sanctioned by several UN resolutions since the invasion last year.
Okay, but now on one hand, we have the coalition that is involved in Iraq, which is a collection of countries principally led by the United States and Great Britain, and then we're looking at drawing in the involvement of other countries, which you're saying Kofi Annan has to shepherd and George Bush has to get in order to move the situation ahead in Iraq. Is that right?
Absolutely. I think it would be great if we could get more commitment from other countries. And I think a lot of countries that are standing on the sidelines basically saying this is America's problem, this is Britain's problem, we don't want to help them, we especially don't want to help George Bush get reelected, they're taking a very short-sighted view of this whole thing because they have to face up to the consequences of American failure, American withdrawal. They would be catastrophic, not only for the United States, but for the entire region and indeed for the world, if Iraq were to degenerate into a Lebanon-style civil war, into a haven of terrorists even more than it is today. Those are very serious consequences for the entire world, and I think all the countries of the world, including those that have been opposed to the invasion, such as France and Germany and others, have a responsibility and a duty to step forward and try to help reach a positive outcome in Iraq, which is still very possible.
Okay, but what I need you both to help me with is what is the likelihood, John Ruggie, what's the likelihood of bridging George Bush's applause lines, bashing the UN at his stump speeches in the midst of an election, and his desire to bring in more countries? How do we bridge that gap?
Before the U.S. election, you don't. Until November the 2nd, absolutely nothing is going to happen anywhere that's worth talking about. In any other country, no leader of any other country as Max said, is going to go out of his or her way at this point in time help George Bush get reelected. He's radioactive for most leaders of most major democracies in the world. It's that simple.
So is this an exercise in futility at the UN?
Or? It's an exercise in posturing to different constituencies and trying to lay down markers for future behavior much more than it is for any immediate on-the-ground gain.
What do you think, Max?
Dick, if I may make a point here,
yeah.
I think, you know, the point that was just made is absolutely correct. I don't think it's going to be very difficult to find common ground between the U.S. and other countries in the U.N. on the issue of Iraq, which is the most divisive one in the world today. I think it should be more possible to find common ground on other issues where the interests of the U.S. and the U.N. and other nations coincide much more. And I'm thinking of issues such as Darfur, where ethnic cleansing is happening in the Sudan, or Syria's occupation of Lebanon, which was an issue where France and the U.S. got together and said, basically called for Syria to give Lebanon more freedom, and Syria ignored that. So I think there has to be more action to follow up on some of these resolutions. Another one is having to do with Iran's nuclear capacity, which is something that the International Atomic Energy Commission agency is looking at very strongly. These are all areas where I think there is a common interest, but the challenge is to give teeth to these high-sounding UN resolutions, and that's very tough because there are members of the Security Council who just do not want to get tough on issues like the Sudan or Syria or others.
Okay, but Max, let me just stop you if I can. Yeah. Sudan and Lebanon and Iran, these are important issues, no question, but are you saying that the United States can find some kind of common cause with the UN on those issues, and that could lead to some sort of rapprochement on the issue of Iraq?
I don't know if it will lead to a rapprochement on Iraq, but, you know, we can put Iraq to one side. We don't have to agree with everybody on everything. We can work with people while disagreeing with them on other issues. And I think we need to get much better at working on issues like Darfur, which is an issue where the UN really could be taking a lead role, but it needs more peacekeeping capacity. It needs more humanitarian intervention capacity than it currently has. And that's very much in the interest of the U.S. to bolster that so that the eyes of the world are not on the U.S. every time there's a humanitarian crisis. It would be great if somebody else had the capacity to go in and do something about it. And so I think the U.S. should try to work with the UN to bolster that capacity, which will be in everybody's interest.
But John, can the U.S. set aside international cooperation on Iraq? Does it have to do that?
Well, progress is being made on some of the – it's very slow progress, but progress is being made on some of the other issues that that Max talks about. But the elephant in the room is, alas, Iraq. And the reason it's Iraq is not – it's not a personal thing between George Bush and other leaders. It is that foreign leaders see Iraq as the first test case of the Bush doctrine, and the Bush doctrine scares the dickens out of other countries. Henry Kissinger had probably the most profound objection to the Bush doctrine. What if this became a principle for every country to follow? That was Henry Kissinger's line, and that's exactly what foreign leaders are saying. So until they hear from George Bush, we've thought about this. We need to move collectively to redefine the rules of the game. We're not going to attack every country that we think may pose a threat, whether it does or not, and so on and so forth. Until major foreign leaders hear that from the Bush administration, cooperation on the issue of Iraq is likely to be very, very low-key, if it exists at all.
Okay, a reminder to our listeners. As we are speaking, Kofi Annan has taken to the stage. He is now talking to the UN General Assembly. We'll be bringing you a part of that speech a little bit later in the program. The election debate, the national debate in this country, is over the United States and its place in the international community, with John Kerry saying it's essential that the U.S. go back to try and rebuild those multilateral connections. George Bush, the Republicans, other people saying not so fast, not so necessary. What are your thoughts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Can the U.S. and the U.N., should the U.S. and the U.N. work at putting aside their differences? It's an appropriate question on the morning when both the Secretary General of the U.N. and the President of the United States are speaking at the meeting of the General Assembly in New York City. We'd like to have you join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. John Ruggie is here with me in Boston. He's a former assistant to the Secretary General of the U.N., now a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And Max Boot is author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's joining us from New York City. And Max, I want to start with you. I want to give you a quote. This from a speech delivered by John Kerry yesterday at New York University. He said to the people there, "After insulting allies and shredding alliances, this president may not have the trust and confidence to bring others to our side in Iraq. But we cannot hope to succeed unless we rebuild and lead strong alliances so that other nations share the burden with us. That is the only way to succeed. Now, if I'm not mistaken, you've been writing columns that challenge that, right?
Well, you know, John Kerry is not in a great position to cast too many stones at George Bush for alienating allies when John Kerry refers to our alliance in Iraq as the coerced and the bought and the bribed, which is a fine way to talk about nations like Italy, Poland, Britain, and others who are sacrificing their young men and women in order to help bring freedom to the Iraqi people.
But you're saying doesn't need friends, doesn't need the sort of friends that he's saying it does in order to press ahead.
No, I agree with John Kerry that we need friends, and I think President Bush agrees with him as well. And I further agree with John Kerry that the Bush administration has not always been very good at getting those friends. But I think we have to be realistic about how much we can expect from foreign allies. I mean, John Kerry is talking as if he wins the election, all of a sudden France and Germany and other countries are going to rush troops into Iraq so America can pull out. And that's just a fantasy. I haven't met anybody who thinks that's going to happen. There's all these countries are not in Iraq because they don't want to be in Iraq. And, you know, it doesn't matter how much the President of the United States would sweet talk them. They don't want to send troops into this volatile, dangerous situation where they were opposed to the invasion to begin with. And, you know, it's not going to get much beyond a token commitment, even if John Kerry is elected. So, yeah, I mean, I think it would be great if you had an alliance, but more of an alliance than we have in Iraq, and we certainly have a lot of countries, but most of the commitment, as John Kerry says, is on the part of the U.S. It would be great if other countries would do more, but we have to be realistic about how much we can expect from others when we're dealing with a very volatile and difficult situation like the one in Iraq.
And John Ruggie, when we look at elections that are supposed to take place in the next 3.5 months, can those elections take place unless there are more nations on board?
If the security situation doesn't improve significantly, it is doubtful that you can have serious elections in Iraq. You'd have to sort of cut out a third of the country, which is in considerable turmoil. In fact, all the major cities these days are in serious turmoil. Yes, you can have an election in Kurdistan, and you might be able to have an election in the south, but you'd have a heck of a time in between because the security situation is so dangerous. I wouldn't be surprised if in another 6 weeks or so, the UN electoral people in Iraq were to say, as far as they're concerned, it's a bad idea to go forward with this January election.
And so what kind of pressure does that, from both of you, what kind of pressure does that put on either the president or the secretary general to say, we need to figure out a way of getting more people involved in providing the security that you're saying is required?
Well, as I say, and I think Max is right, there are not countries out there just chomping to get into Iraq and to provide troops. However, I think the European allies in particular realize that the stakes for them, if Kerry were elected, are very high. They would have to come through with something. Otherwise, Kerry is locked into a Bush-like foreign policy for the foreseeable future.
I want to just stop you for there for half a second. Max, we will get back to you. I'd like to go to New York, where Kofi Annan is, as I said, talking to the General Assembly and moving to his point about the importance of the rule of international law.
And weaknesses. Too often, it is applied selectively and enforced arbitrarily. It lacks the teeth that turn a body of laws into an effective legal system. Where enforcement capacity does exist, as in the Security Council, many feel it is not always used fairly or effectively. Where the rule of law is most earnestly invoked, as in the Commission on Human Rights, those invoking it do not always practice what they preach. Those who seek to bestow legitimacy must themselves embody it, and those who invoke international law must themselves submit to it. Just as within a country, respect for the law depends on a sense that all have a say in making and implementing it, so it is in our global community. No nation must feel excluded. All must feel that international law belongs to them and protects their legitimate interests.
We're listening to the speech, which is coming to us live from New York City, the UN headquarters. Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, making his opening remarks to this session of the General Assembly of the United Nations. Max Boot, when he says those who seek to bestow legitimacy must themselves embody it, and those who invoke international law must themselves submit to it, seems like pretty specific criticism aimed at President Bush.
Absolutely. Not very subtle digs at the U.S. and our policy. But, you know, the thing that distresses me listening to that is that Kofi Annan seems more distressed about the American-led occupation of Iraq, which toppled Saddam Hussein, than he was about the many violations of international law that Saddam Hussein himself had committed over a reign that lasted decades, and the most recent of which involved the U.N. Oil for Food program, where, by many accounts, Saddam managed to funnel something like $10 billion while the U.N. looked the other way while administering sanctions over Iraq. And that's a huge, huge scandal, which basically put the U.N. bureaucracy into bed with one of the most oppressive and corrupt regimes in the world.
But surely, Max, the difference in Kofi Annan's mind is that he can talk to the United States, he can talk to the president and say, you know, this is what I expect of a democratically elected country, the leader of the free world. He might have higher expectations of the U.S. than he would of Saddam Hussein in obeying resolutions passed by the U.N.
Well, I don't think that the U.S. disobeyed any U.N. resolutions. I mean, we can argue about this until the cows come home, but, you know, both the U.S. and British governments are full of lawyers who have drawn up extensive briefs explaining why this was not a violation of international law. And remember, the 1999 invasion of Kosovo was also not done in accordance with any U.N. Security Council resolution. I mean, Kofi Annan is just dreaming if he's trying to suggest that any use of force outside the U.N. Security Council is illegitimate. That's just not the case. I don't think we'd want it to be the case, because that would basically give countries like China or Russia or others a veto over the actions of Western democracies, which is not something we necessarily want to have.
John, go ahead.
I just want to challenge one thing that Max said, namely that the U.N. did not look the other way when Saddam Hussein was in power. After all, there were sanctions in place. There were arms inspectors in the country until they got thrown out when the U.S. attacked in 1998, and Saddam wouldn't let them back in. We now hear even the Bush administration saying that those sanctions and arms inspectors, in fact, did deliver on their promise not to allow Saddam Hussein to reconstitute weapons of mass destruction. That was the UN mandate in Iraq. So the UN certainly didn't look away. It did what it was asked to do.
Well, if I could just clarify what I meant when it looked away at the way that Saddam Hussein and his henchmen funneled billions of dollars that was supposed to go to the Iraqi people in order to fund their own palaces, in order to fund their own army, and yes, in order to fund some weapons programs they were not supposed to have, such as the ballistic missile development, which we now know is going on. I mean, I agree with your point that the UN sanctions were more or less keeping Saddam from developing weapons of mass destruction, but there was a question about how long those sanctions would last. But the larger point that I was trying to raise was the morality of the whole sanctions regime, which was basically allowing Saddam Hussein to say that the West and the sanctions regime was killing Iraqi children because they were not getting milk and other essentials, at the same time that Saddam Hussein had a huge palace in every Iraqi city and was able to squirrel away billions of dollars that he was able to funnel away under the table. That's where the U.N. was looking the other way, and that's what Paul Volcker is now investigating on behalf of the U.N. Security Council.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We will not come to a definitive answer on whether or not the invasion of Iraq was an illegal or a legal act on this program, but it's one of the points that is being debated this very morning at the United Nations, and it is one of the points that needs to be stepped past as the UN and the U.S. look for some common ground in moving to elections in that country. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the personalities and the issues at stake here. I want to go first to Louisville, Kentucky, and John's joining us. Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What do you think?
Well, you know, during this conversation, and obviously I'm a U.S. citizen, that I wonder if it's not understood the role that the United States plays in the world right now. When there are issues that pop up like the Gulf War or humanitarian crises, we are expected to, and it's demanded from the rest of the world, that we pick up a disproportionate, even to our size in the world, mm-hmm. a disproportionate amount of the resources and assistance. Yet when it comes to something like just enforcing resolutions that have been passed in the UN, we have to give everyone an equal voice. And, you know, it just doesn't work that way. And you know, I understand there are a lot of countries that are upset with us, But at the same time, countries like France depended upon us in World War II, and there are others since that needed us to step in and use our might. Yet when we need to try to solve problems, as the United States does, a lot of these other countries are more interested in their own issues and their own self-interest, whether they loan things to Saddam and others.
The expectations that the world has for where the U.S. will get involved, what the U.S. will pay for, take the country in your way and place it a little bit separate and apart from other nations at the U.N., gives the U.S. in effect the right to, you know, act with the U.N. when appropriate, John, or act alone or with NATO, however it sees fit. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Well, yeah, for the most part. I mean, I think in a more concise version, the world expects us to pick up a disproportionate amount of the bill when there are issues that need to be fixed. But when it comes time to help us solve problems,
right,
or address issues like it was in Iraq, they just want to turn their head and have us deal with it on our own, and even criticize us when we do, despite how much we've helped their countries in past times. And I am frankly disappointed. I've lost my grandparents fought in World War II. My father fought in Vietnam, which was started as a French skirmish. And, you know, in those situations, it makes me feel bad now that as we're trying to solve problems in the Middle East, they would rather try to deal with and live with problems and criticize us when we're actually taking proactive action.
So, John Ruggie, maybe a different set of rules ought to apply under the circumstances.
Well, I guess I'd like to say a couple of things. One, there has to be a statute of limitations. The United States helped France in World War II. Does that mean that the U.S. therefore has something hanging over France's head for the rest of eternity, that France always has to agree with the United States on any issue that the U.S. chooses? The fact is that France agrees with us on more issues than not. They happen to disagree very strongly on the Iraq war, as is their right. I'd also like to say that we had so much international support for the first Gulf War because George Bush's father aligned a real coalition. We had so much support, we made money on that war. There was so much money coming in to support the effort that we actually ended up with a net profit at the end of the operation. So it can be done. You can align a coalition in support of U.S. and other objectives without alienating the rest of the world in the process. And one final point, if I may, Dick. We Americans may not care what other people think about us at the end of the day. But in democracies, leaders of other countries have to care what their people think about them, because that's who they get elected by. And if you have 85, 87, 89% public opinion polls opposing the Iraq war and opposing George Bush, no foreign leader is going to go out of his way to get himself killed in his own domestic electoral system by supporting George Bush.
Jump in here, Max. Different set of rules for the U.S. What are your thoughts?
I think the caller is onto something, because I think the U.S. is held to a double standard. When we don't step forward and solve international problems, we're derided for being isolationist, for having our heads stuck in the sand. And this is the case, for example, with the situation between the Israelis and Palestinians, where the Bush administration is attacked for not coming in and solve the problem. But when we do come in and try to solve the problem, we're attacked for being hegemonic, unilateralist, bullying, and all this kind of stuff. So I there's kind of a sense that sometimes the United States can't win. We're damned if we do and damned if we don't. And you see this all the time from countries that are castigating the United States for precipitously going into Iraq, at the same time are saying, well, please, we need the United States leadership in Darfur, we need it in here, there, and everywhere. And, you know, it's hard for an American president to figure out how to please all constituencies. But I think the record is pretty clear that when the United States leads, very often others will follow, and that if the United States doesn't lead, nothing happens. And we saw this much more recently. I mean, the caller referred to the liberation of France, but we've seen this much more recently in the 1990s in the case of ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, where in 1995 in Bosnia and in 1999 in Kosovo, the United States stepped forward and led coalitions to put an end to Serbian ethnic cleansing, was a good thing.
Sorry.
And it wasn't going to happen without American leadership. The Europeans had dropped the ball on that, just as they're now dropping the ball on Darfur and other crises that we face.
I want to go back to our callers, to our numbers, 1-800-423-8255. To Boston, Ahmed is joining us on the line. Hi, Ahmed. What are you thinking?
It's actually Amit, but
sorry about that. Go ahead.
But what I wanted to say was that what strikes me, I mean, we're having the same debate about going into Iraq, but in this case, the issue, I think, is that the U.S. constantly criticizes the UN. It says that we have to step up. The world community demands that the U.S. step up. But the U.S., and especially this president, has done nothing to build up the institution. In every speech, all he says, he criticizes the UN, that it doesn't come up, discharge its responsibility. But there is no conversation about that, well, what can, you may not agree with us, but what can we as the U.S. do to build this institution?
Ahmed, what is the, why does the U.S. have a responsibility to build up the United Nations if it's seen as a place where there's too much talk and not enough action?
Well, I mean, if that's the complaint, then the U.S. should actually change, try to change that and not just criticize it. If you say that either you build up the institution or you disregard it completely, you can't pick and choose constantly when it's favor, when you want to go to war in Iraq, you say that we need the UN, the United Nations, to sanction our going into war in Iraq and not do anything to support the UN to build it up as an institution.
Max, let's hear from you here.
Well, I think it's an exaggeration to say the United States does nothing to support the UN, because the U.S. is, after all, the largest donor to the United Nations. There's no getting around that. But I think the caller does raise an interesting point, and I think that certainly more can be done to make the UN an effective instrument dealing with the most dire crises in the world, especially humanitarian crises like Darfur, where no country has an overwhelming national interest in stepping forward, intervening, but there's kind of a general sense of the world that something should be done. And I think the UN could be an instrument for doing that, but it has to overcome decades of inefficiency, bureaucracy, failures in places like Bosnia, which are well documented. And I think there is room and a need for the U.S. and the U.N. to work together to try to build up that international capacity to deal with these crises. And part of it is defining new rules of the game for when you can intervene and when you don't. I think that is an important project for both sides going forward.
And the point upon which the two sides happen to be disagreeing at this very moment is what to do in Iraq. Who needs to make a gesture to try and find some common ground between the U.N. and the U.S.? Or is that something that even needs to be done? We are more than 2 months away from an election in the United States and about 4 months away from planned elections in Iraq. Can those go ahead unless something is done relatively soon? 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about the United States and the United Nations at the same time as the president is making his speech. He will be speaking a little bit later this morning to assembled world leaders in New York. We've already heard a little bit of the Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, who's been quite critical of the United States, accusing it of not necessarily following international law. We'd like to hear from you on this program, whether or not the United States and the UN need to find some way of putting aside their differences on Iraq. How much does international cooperation matter anymore? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Max, let me, if I can, come back to you, because something that we passed over a little quickly earlier in the program is pretty crucial to this conversation, and that is the elections that are slated for January. We keep hearing from the president in his election speeches that Iraq has itself an interim prime minister, they have a national council, and they are going to have elections in January. How important is it, in your view, that those elections go ahead and that they go ahead in January?
I think it is very important that they go ahead, because they have been publicly announced, and that is a basic fundamental demand of the majority of Iraqis, led the Shiites, whose most prominent leader is Ayatollah Sistani, who has said we have to have elections to legitimize a national government. And we have to, I think, go forward with that and not give a small number of terrorists and guerrillas a veto on the ability of the whole nation to determine its future democratically. And obviously, it's going to be very difficult to have a vote in places like Fallujah if they're held by insurgents, and that's a huge problem. But I think it is possible to have voting in the rest of the country, because the largest cities, which are Mosul and Baghdad and Basra, I think are secure enough to allow voting to go forward. And certainly the South, which is where about 60% of the population lives, I think is secure enough. And certainly the Kurdish region, which is another 20%, is secure enough. So, I mean, the debilitating security problems are occurring in about 20% of the country, the Sunni triangle. And
what do you do if the UN election workers, the people who are already tapped to run these elections, say, fine. You know, obviously we're not going to go to Ramadi and Bakuba and Fallujah, but you know what? We're not going to Najaf and we're not going to Basra. We're not going to those places because we don't want to be, you know, targets in Kirkuk. At that point, does it become more important for the United States and the UN to say, we got to sit down, we got to sort this out?
Well, sure. I mean, I think you have to have enough security for the election workers to do their work. And you've seen that it's a challenge in Afghanistan, but it has been surmounted in Afghanistan, despite a lot of fears that it wouldn't happen. Something like 10 million Afghanis have registered to vote, which has been a tremendous success. It's possible we may well be surprised by the success in Iraq. But, you know, I think it would be great if other nations would step forward to provide added security for the poll workers, which is something that I think is in everybody's interest.
And how, John Ruggie, do you get those other nations to step forward to provide that sort of security under the circumstances? You're already saying things are going to remain exactly as they are for another 2 months, and that, unless my math's wrong, doesn't leave time to hit that January deadline.
I think that's probably right. There are two challenges. One is the security challenge, and the UN electoral officials who are out there trying to put together voter registration lists and that sort of thing need to be protected. Secondly, if they go out there protected by U.S. forces, it puts them in a real dilemma.
They become greater targets?
They become greater targets and they lose their legitimacy. They're accompanied by U.S. Marines or U.S. Army personnel, and they're out there trying to organize an independent election. The credibility of the effort suffers. We haven't yet been able to convince other countries to provide troops for this particular purpose, in part because of the issue of who would command them. Would they have to become part of the American command structure, or could they become part of a separate command? That hasn't been resolved. And then finally, as Max pointed out earlier, people aren't rushing out to provide troops for Iraq under the current circumstances in any case. So we've got a number of challenges, and they're not pointing in the right direction.
But
they're not being resolved.
Let me just take the other point that Max made earlier in the program, and that is that if John Kerry were to be elected, there wouldn't be 50,000 legionnaires from France ready to be, you know, to go marching in saying, "Pah, you know, you got rid of Bush, now we'll stand with you." Will it turn at all?
There's not 50,000 legionnaires out there who are going to be parachuted into Baghdad. There's no question about that. However, I've just come back from Europe and interviewed people in foreign ministries, close allies, who've come to the recognition that if Kerry is elected, they'd better do something different from what they're doing now, because otherwise they undermine the whole Kerry argument about Bush being unilateral. Kerry would be multilateral. Kerry can't be multilateral by himself. Others would have to join him, and they're beginning to realize that they would have to step up a little more to make a Kerry presidency in foreign policy viable.
1-800-423-8255, a chance to bring our listeners back into Boston, Massachusetts. Ted's on the line. Hi, Ted.
Good morning, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine. What do you think?
My thought is that it seems pretty clear the way things have gone with our approach, that this unilateral effort that we've made and saying we're going to go it alone and this macho kind of approach is really, we're seeing it come apart in so many different ways. I mean, our position in the world has suffered so greatly because of it, and we're not a rogue nation, but we're acting like a rogue nation in a roguish way by just saying we don't care about collaboration and cooperation and what other people think. And you know, I think that the United Nations is a frustrating organization in that they sometimes seem like, you know, in Darfur, they're totally caught up and just sort of gently moving, you know, baby steps forward when there's a real crisis. But nonetheless, it is the only thing that we have, and it needs to be improved rather than being told it's a, you know, that it's not a relevant organization.
Ted, I want to, if you would, just to stay on the line for a minute here. And Max, you made a case in a piece that I read, you'd written a couple of days ago, where you're saying, in fact, without that obvious before the cameras multilateral cooperation, the United States is in fact bringing other nations in the Middle East and elsewhere along. How do you make that case to Ted, who's saying we need to have that multilateral image?
Well, it's true that we do have problems with our image in other parts of the world, and certainly the public opinion polls reflect that. But what people lose sight of is that there is a lot of effective cooperation going on between the United States and various countries, including those such as France and Germany, which do not support us in Iraq. But we're working very closely together in places like Afghanistan, also in the broader war on terrorism, and also in trying to stop nuclear weapons proliferation through the Proliferation Security Initiative. In fact, there is much better cooperation today than there was 4 or 5 years ago, when the United States was supposedly being more multilateral. But today, I think various countries around the world see that there's a growing threat from terrorism. They see some of these dangers that the United States saw so vividly on September 11, 2001, because since then, the terrorists have been attacking in Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Turkey, in Indonesia, all over the world. And all those countries are being drawn closer into the American orbit and to try to cooperate with us against our common enemies. And I think we are getting very good cooperation, which a lot of which goes on behind the scenes of the intelligence capacity and in various kinds of behind-the-scenes things, but it is very effective.
Let's let Ted back in here. Ted, I don't know, are you being persuaded here that maybe there's more multilateral cooperation going on than people are willing to recognize?
I think perhaps there is more than some people are aware of, and certainly that I'm aware of. I'm not on the inside, but it's pretty clear that to me that with all of our power, we need to be setting a good example, and we're setting, you know, a very poor example for what leadership is. There may be some more collaboration than I read about or hear about, but I don't think that it's at the level that it should be, and I don't think that it's producing the kind of impact that we want it to have.
John Ruggie, you said you've just come back from traveling. How is this measured?
There is considerable collaboration at some technical levels in relation to terrorism, including money laundering, including intelligence sharing, and all of that. That's improved tremendously because of 9/11, because of the Madrid bombings and everybody else. Max is right that at that level, we're all in this together and we need to cooperate. At the policy level is where the differences are. President Musharraf, on whom we depend for our presence in Afghanistan, was interviewed yesterday on one of the networks and said, I fear that the United States is losing the war on terror because it's not dealing with the root causes. The root causes for him being the Palestinian-Israeli situation and issues related to poverty and such in countries like Pakistan itself, which drives children into the madrasas.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the lines, to Providence, Rhode Island. Stephen's with us. Hi, Stephen.
How are you?
Fine.
I have 2 points that I'd like the panelists to respond to. The one gentleman a little while ago talking about the issue of the United States is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. That seems to me to be a lot of kind of whining, in a sense, which I think actually the Bush administration is guilty of that same kind of whining, that the most powerful country in the world, why won't you all go along with us? But when you don't cooperate with us, we'll attack you and so forth. So I'd like some comment on that. But also,
can you just hang on then, Stephen? Let's deal with that before we lose it. That was a point that Max made earlier. And Max,
sure.
You go ahead.
Well, I guess I'll deny the charge of whining. I think I'm just commenting on the reality, and I think we have to live with it and just go on and try to show strong leadership. But I mean, if I could just come back to an earlier point that is relevant to this as well, I think, which is the issue of U.S. cooperation with our allies. I think it goes beyond merely technical or inconsequential. It has been very consequential, and we see it, for example, in the past year in the uncovery of the Khan nuclear ring based in Pakistan, which was one of the greatest victories ever in the battle against nuclear proliferation, which happened because of cooperation that we got from Britain and France and Germany, and then ultimately from Pakistan, and it helped to defuse Libya's weapons of mass destruction program. There are very concrete consequences that we're getting from it, and the question, of course, will be whether we can replicate those victories in much harder cases like Iran and North Korea. But I think we are seeing some concrete benefits from this cooperation that is going on between the U.S. and our allies, which doesn't get talked about enough and which I do think is important.
Now, Stephen, you didn't get an answer to your question. Do you want to stick with that or do you want to move on?
Well, the other question that I had or comment is about this election issue in January. And my sense that this entire war from its inception now to the quote-unquote elections that are supposed to happen in January 2005 is all driven by a very artificial timetable, when we went to war, why we went to war then. I think the Bush administration expected, as Kerry pointed out yesterday, we'd be down to 40,000 troops or fewer by this point. Bush would be heralded as having won a war. He's now got to go for re-election, at a time now and is sort of saying, well, we'll at least get elections in by January. And I think it's just absolutely unrealistic. I mean, it's ironic to me to hear the critics say Kerry's unrealistic to think there's going to be international cooperation coming his way if he's president, but somehow elections in January are realistic when so many commentators are saying absolutely impossible, not enough security, would be an illegitimate election even if it were to happen.
Max, so, this is what I hear, this is what I read, that under current circumstances those elections won't happen.
Well, remember, people were saying the same thing a few months ago in Afghanistan, and in fact their election was postponed once, but it's going forward in a few weeks' time, and by all indications will come off successfully. We don't know what the security situation in Iraq is going to look like in January. Certainly right now the situation is pretty serious, especially in the Sunni triangle, and it would be very difficult to have voting there. There's no question about it. But I think you have to ask yourself, you know, what's the alternative to having voting? That's basically to have an appointed government continue in power, which I don't think helps the situation. I think having more democratic legitimacy for the government will be a help in trying to combat the terrorists and guerrillas, and I think that has to be kept in mind.
Okay, but the president, John Ruggie, you know, has set the elections in January as something of a test of his own success in that country. So is it reasonable to use them in that way?
It would be very difficult for the president now to back down on the idea of having elections in Iraq in January. So much of his own position on Iraq in our own electoral campaign depends on that January date. But the problem is you can't organize elections overnight. And at the moment, the security in too much of the country is too fragile or worse for the election organizing activities that are required to take place. You can't pull an election out of a hat like a rabbit in a magic trick. They have to be on the ground. They have to organize. They have to put voter rolls together. It's not happening in enough places at the pace that's required for a January election.
Okay, quick last comment, and that is Peter Greer said at the beginning that George Bush is speaking to an international audience and he is speaking to a domestic audience when he begins his speech at the UN. John Ruggie, is it more domestic in your view? Is that really who he's talking to?
The election is on November 2nd. That's the critical constituency for George Bush today at the United Nations.
John, and Max, do you agree with that?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, but I think there's also the possibility Bush could win over more countries once, if they realize he's going to win re-election. They're going to have to realize that they have to play ball with him, and so he may get some of that cooperation that John Kerry says that he would get if he won as well.
Max, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Max Boot is Senior Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations. John Ruggie, thank you for coming in. John is a professor of government at Harvard's Kennedy School. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.